This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Michael Medaglia. He is the director of the film Deep Dark. Michael, it's great having you on the show.
Hey, Robert. Nice talking to you, too. It's exciting to be here.
And I'm also joined here with my co-host, Sam Kevorkian.
Thanks for having me so far.
So, Michael, this is your first feature-length film. But previous to that, you've done a number of short films.
Yeah, a couple of short films, music videos, and things like that. Some documentaries, actually, short documentaries. But Deep Dark was the first feature. I wanted to do a feature for a while, and finally got the chance. Definitely a big learning experience too, I'll tell you that.
I actually discovered the film, it's on Hulu, and Hulu's a big media outlet, but they have been picking up a lot of smaller independent films. How did your film get picked up by Hulu?
Well, we have distribution in the U.S., Canada and Australia, and are the same distributor for all those places. And they actually, through their connections, got us on Hulu and a few other places.
And this film, it's classified under horror for marketing purposes, but you told me it's more of a kind of bizarro fiction or weird fiction type film.
Yeah. I mean, when I wrote it, I always intended it to be something of a cult film. Not that you can really, try to make a cult film, but it was sort of hearkening to those types of films. It's only nominally a horror film. It's not especially scary. There's no jump scares really. It's for me, it's a little bit more in the vein of a weird fiction. If there was such a section in the video store or on Netflix or Hulu, but there is none, so it gets lumped into horror or fantasy, and people do that for marketing reasons. It's the distributor just thought they might sell more if they labeled it as such, and you can even see the poster they went with. There's a little bit more horror.
Well, there's even a caption. It's something like, I forget what it is. Is it "Be careful what you wish for"? That's very horror-like.
Yeah. It's funny. The distributor actually wanted to go with "This ain't no glory hole," which wasn't my idea. But you kind of sort of with a distributor, they their job is to make as much money as possible on the film, and hopefully you get some of that. And so we let them do their thing. I don't have any, gripes against that. It's sort of, it was in their hands and they got to make the poster. Maybe one day, if we re-release it or something like that, we'll do a different poster or something like that.
So the movie poster, so you're saying you didn't design it, but it shows these it shows the hole and these bloody, sharp things coming out. In right. The movie, the hole is not. There's some weird scenes, but it looks different than the movie.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you go online, you'll see two versions of the poster. One is more of a smiling hole, and that's actually our original poster. It was inspired by the Cheshire Cat of Alice in Wonderland. If you go on Hulu or Netflix or Amazon, you'll see this sort of bloody sharp tooth thing with bloody handprints on the wall, and that's the one they wanted to go with. But what can you do?
So I got the first question coming in. This is by a commentator going by the name Ricky Dickey. He asks, what is your favorite bizarro fiction writer?
Oh, yeah, bizarro fiction. That is a good question. You know, does oh, what's her name? Does Kelly Link count as bizarro fiction?
I don't think I've read Kelly Link.
Oh. Well, maybe she's a little bit more magical realism. I don't know, but I'm definitely a fan of hers. But I think there was another guy I read. Trying to think of his name. Maybe I can find it here. Jeremy Robert Johnson. I read one of his books and really
liked
it.
Oh, we did interview a bizarro fiction writer named Cameron Pierce. Not sure if you've heard of him.
No. No, I'll have to check it out. Does he have good stuff?
Yeah. Hmm. I'm familiar with his work, but the other two I haven't heard of.
Oh, yeah, they're both pretty good. Kelly Link is fantastic, but yeah, I don't know if she quite classifies as bizarro. Worth a look-see.
So we were kind of talking about the theme of a horror, and when I first saw the film, I was kind of more expecting the horror cliche. I think one cliche you see in a lot of horror films is someone discovering a hole that's like a portal to hell. You've seen that a lot in films.
Yeah, it's true. It was that, and probably the other big cliche is having to feed it people.
Oh, yeah. I remember as a kid, there was a show on Nickelodeon, Are You Afraid of the Dark? And there was some episode about a boy discovering a monster in a basement who he actually feeds his bullies to in exchange for toys. That's one of them.
Wow. Yeah, something every kid wishes they had, right? Yeah, I mean, I don't know if it's obvious, but there's a lot of relation of Deep Dark. There's a little bit of a love letter to, oh my God, I'm spacing out on the name now, but the Audrey to Little Shop of Horrors. It's definitely got a little bit of a, you know, that to it. And so the hole would be sort of like the plant. It's just kind of it's an old story. It's a Faustian myth. It kind of goes all the way back to Faust, where there's this, you know, power that you can have, but there's a sacrifice you have to make for it. Dorian Gray, almost the same thing.
So do you see the hole more as being kind of dependent on him and having some kind of relationship going on? You think it would be too simplistic to just say the hole is just this, like, evil demon?
Yeah, it wasn't, for me, it wasn't a demon, but, I mean, when I made the film, I didn't want to specifically tell the audience, hey, this is what this is. You know, the hole is supposed to be a mystery among other things. And so I didn't really want to, you know, I wanted the audience to piece things together a little bit. Like, for me, when I watch a film, that's what I like to do. And so I didn't want to come out and just explain it. I will tell you what, you know, when you write a story or when you direct a story, you have to make choices as to what things are. And I made some choices. For me, the whole is, it's an entity. And it's also essentially a lack of something. It's a space, you know. It's not an actual thing. It's the lack of a thing that just happens to have a personality. I guess you could call it a demon, but you know, for me, a demon implies morally evil, and I didn't really feel like the hole was morally evil. It just wanted, you know, wanted things, and tried to give it a more morally ambiguous personality. You know, it gets jealous, it wants things, but it's not necessarily trying to harm people. However, it's also, you know, supposed to be very old and maybe just doesn't care so much about you know, the current society morals, you know.
Oh, because there's the references to some artists from Andy Warhol to even a Nagel who did the Duran Duran posters.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So the idea is, you know, you see some artists throughout history and we have no idea why they were popular at the time. And this was my, you know, kind of way of explaining it. Well, you know, maybe Nagel found a hole that inspired him and also helped, you know, make him wildly popular.
Was the story Too Deep Dark influenced by any of your real life experiences?
It's funny. People ask me that a lot. not really. No, I mean, well, okay. So yes and no, obviously I didn't find any hole or source of inspiration. Some of the story, I think, was at a long time ago when I wrote it. And I wrote it close to 2006. I think some of the the whole being jealous stuff, and the love triangle was a little bit inspired by a relationship I had at the time. And so it was I think every artist experiences this to some degree where, you know, you might be in a relationship with a person, but you also have a quote unquote relationship with your art. And there's a push pull, I think, with both, you know, you have to find a good balance between both of them. And at the time when I wrote it, I don't think I was doing a very good job of finding that balance.
And as an artist, I can relate to the character because there's this constant pressure where if you're an artist, you feel that maybe you have these great visions, but you also have these setbacks. There's a creative setbacks, or even and there's the cases where you have a success at something and then you feel that you're not getting your dues. And I think artists struggle a lot with this. So I think this movie really is something that artists can relate to, whether they're painters or filmmakers. And there's the whole thing of people kind of putting him down and dismissing his work, and then there's his mom telling him that he should go look for a real job, and that kind of leads, that's like the beginning of the film, and that leads up to the whole plot, the introduction.
I think it's something almost every artist has experienced at one point or another. Certainly me too. I mean, specifically those scenes that you saw, but that, I've definitely had that feeling before.
There is the whole background story of Uncle Felix, who is, he's a successful artist who's his uncle, and he hooks him up with the apartment. And apparently he became successful through the same hole. And there's a beginning scene that shows him having this nightmare. You were telling me that you were going to put more about his background story, but then you decided to leave that out.
There was actually a different beginning that we, you know, it's in the script. We ended up shooting something slightly different. It's still a dream sequence, but you know, it's a low budget film, and we had to change the scene a little bit to work within our means. But it's actually if you read the script or check out the storyboards, it is a slightly different scene. It's less horrific. He ends up getting sucked into his belly button. It's like his belly button turns into this vortex and pulls him in. He sort of folds folds into himself. But the reason you asked me, you know, one of the inspirations for having that there, and I felt pretty strongly about this, and even the other, you know, other filmmakers involved, the editor and so on and so forth, I think felt the same way that, you know, this story is a pretty fantastical story. It's bizarre. And in order to make it feel believable, I think, or at least to put the audience in the right frame of mind to watch it, I felt like it needed to start out with something that kind of sets you up for the type of film it is. And so that was part of why this that scene was there.
There's also a bizarre scene where he has sex with a hole.
Yeah.
Which is, some people say it's supposed to be, is that where the whole, like, glory hole thing came from?
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably where they got it from. Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't really something that, I mean, the glory hole thing, it wasn't something that I specifically was envisioning in the film. It just sort of, I think it was like a natural evolution of what happens when you have a, you know, semi-sexual relationship with a hole. It only can go so many places, you know? So that's where it ended up.
When you were making the film, and the hole is very vague, there's a kind of a footage through the hole. Did you have a kind of visual image of the entity on the other side?
Oh, yeah, that's a good question. So for me, the way the hole works is, and again, this is really, anyone can have a different interpretation. In fact, many people do. But for me, the hole can create things, it can generate things that come out of it. And so, you know, obviously this is a spoiler, but, the part with the teeth, all that stuff, those are not necessarily what is inside the hole. That is what she created at that time. So the things that end up coming out of her that he uses in his art, those are things that she creates. The sucking of the oxygen, that was, you know, something she generates by a pressure differential inside of her. So I don't know, I hope that explains things a little bit there.
You were mentioning how you like to kind of keep the audience in a sense a mystery, not giving away all the details, keeping them in suspense. I know another director who does that is David Lynch. Are you a fan of Lynch?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah, and I'm sure some of his films were inspirational to our filmmaking style. I mean, certainly Blue Velvet for sure, and some of his earlier films, definitely.
Are you a fan of Twin Peaks and the new series?
Oh, yeah. Well, definitely a fan of the original. Probably season one is, I think, the best one. And I'm currently watching the new season, seeing where it's going. It's definitely has its moments, you know, but maybe could use a little bit of editing, I think. I don't know. I don't want to get too into it, but I'm watching every minute, and it's there are definitely some gems in there. So I can't wait to my wife is out of town. I have to wait for her to get back until we can watch the next episode. Can't watch it without her. She won't let me.
I guess Twin Peaks does have a theme of like a portal, the portal to the Black Lodge.
Yeah, that there's a duality theme there too. Yeah, it's been interesting.
Okay, so we have one more question from Alex J. Goldstein. Do you believe in the supernatural?
I guess I don't per se. believe in the supernatural, but I guess you could say I'm agnostic. You know, there could always be something there that we don't understand. I'd like to think that there is, but haven't seen any definite proof yet. You know, and this is the, you know, I am an engineer by background. Have a degree in engineering, and so you know a little bit more right-brained and definitely would need to see a little bit of proof, but I'm actually very interested in it, and I do read up a lot on it, so I don't know. I'm not sure what to tell you there.
One more question from Cartrell Payne. Why do people like horror movies? Is it because of our biological wiring?
Well, I think there's a lot of different ways in which people like horror movies. I think it fulfills a different need in different people. Certainly some people like to be scared. You know, they like that thrill. There's a visceral thrill there. And anyone that likes horror movies for that reason probably should not watch Deep Dark, because it's not, there's no jump scares in it. It doesn't really, you know, make you jump anywhere. But some people love that. And that, I think, just gets their blood up. It gets their heart pumping. And that's why people like that. But I think there's also another type of horror fan that likes to watch, you know, death or horrible things happening to people. And I think that...
Are you talking about the whole kind of a torture porn genre? Like films like Hostel?
Well, that and just any kind of, you know, seeing just, I guess, the notion of death, you know? So it doesn't have to be gory, just the idea that something could be out there, you know? And yeah, I think it's the way it plays on is it kind of lets you laugh at death a little bit, or to come to grips with it. You know, you're watching a movie, you're seeing people dying, you're seeing something horrible happen, but you know it's just a movie, or at least by the end of the movie, you know, it's over, and you've sort of, you've watched it, you've kind of been through that. And I think it functions in a similar way that a nightmare might. You know, it kind of helps you get over it. It might help you come to terms with death a little bit better. So when it actually does happen, or, you know, if you actually do see it, it's not so horrible. At least that's my opinion.
Wouldn't Saving Private Ryan be along the same lines? And that's not a horror movie.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think any kind of death on screen can give you that feeling. But perhaps horror movies, you know, that's when you're watching a horror movie, that's what you're going there for. You know, that's the ride you're taking on purpose.
Right. The thing I like about horror movies is a complete sense of helplessness. Like, there's a sense in which there's no justice, and like, people are just getting killed with impunity.
Do you feel like there should be some sort of moral, you know, implication in the film? Usually there's a story there, and there's some sort of redemption, or some kind of change, or some kind of vanquishing of the evil in some way, or yes, escaping it.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And so, I mean, certainly there's that feeling of helplessness, but in most cases, not all, but most cases, there's that being able to overcome it in some way.
Would you say that there is a moral or message you want people to get out of the film?
Not really, no. I mean, I don't think there's any specific message. You can you can make of it what you will. And I was hoping to entertain a little bit, make people wonder a little bit, and also make people sympathize with the whole, to make people feel like it was not just an evil creature, that it actually had feelings. I mean, one of the probably the tougher things, tougher aspects of making the film was the fact that Sean, the actor who plays Herman, is playing against a hole in the wall. Literally, it's just a wall. And so to give it some humanity was one of the things we tried to do. And he did a great job doing that. And, we tried to use all the cinematic tools we had, the sound and the cinematography and stuff like that. But hopefully, people who watch it do feel like there was something there. There was some kind of substance.
It's interesting, when you were on the set, the magic kind of came in afterwards, in my production, adding in the voice and all the special effects. You didn't feel anything special standing there with the actor next to the hole?
Well, I felt something, yes, but I think, if you were there, there was a lot of just, a lot of the crew was watching it and was like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. Not in a mean way, but just, there was an absurdity to it for sure, plus, we didn't have Denise Poirier, the voice of the whole, the voice of the En Flux. She wasn't there. So we had someone else stand in to do the lines, and, they were not
necessary. How did you select her for the voice of the whole? Denise has done some work in the past on cartoons and animes.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. When I wrote the screenplay, I always just had her voice in mind. I don't know why. It was just something I was imagining as I was writing it. And when it came time to finally do it, finally record the voice, I contacted her and asked her if she was up for it. And it just, so happened that she was free and available. And we just recorded it all in one day. So that really worked out. And, I think she was fantastic.
There's also an element of dark comedy to the film. What would you say are some of the funniest scenes in the film and how you utilize comedy?
I think there was a lot, for me, there was a lot of, many of the scenes were comedic. Maybe more so than many people thought. I've noticed watching the film with a few people versus a crowd. With a crowd, it's nice because usually there's one or two people that will laugh at the sort of twisted moments, which is great because that was the intent. With just one or two people, I sometimes feel like people which might not think that it might be a funny scene, but for me, one of the funniest scenes is the sex scene, not the part where the sex is happening, but the part where we pan and then you see Joel in the window, watching them, and the look on his face, like, to me, that's,
oh yeah,
that's a funny scene.
Like, I didn't, is that the other artist who he has a rivalry with?
Yeah. So that was, that was supposed to be kind of a demented, humorous scene. Let me see what else. Also the part where Joel, loads of spoilers in this, but, where Joel dies, where his intestines are sucked out and it's kind of slurped like a long strand of spaghetti.
Oh yeah.
That was purely for laughs, I think. It's supposed to be gruesome, but it's I mean, gruesome in the funniest possible way. I hope you guys felt the same way. I don't know.
Yeah. Oh, then there was also the scene where the main character is at his art exhibition and he's hanging up and the blood droops everywhere, spills everywhere, and he.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, the Bloodmobile. That was definitely a hard scene to shoot. Probably one of the hardest. But yeah.
Did you make those mobiles yourself?
No. So most of the mobiles in the film are made by the same. Oh wait, let me think. No. The mobiles that Herman makes before he meets the hole are all, you know, not very good mobiles. And so we actually had a quote unquote bad mobile making party before the film where a bunch of people got together and made mobiles, like non-art people that were not necessarily artists or people that just weren't really, you know, trying to make good. They were trying to make bad mobiles. And so they made a bunch and I got to pick the worst ones or the best ones. and so those are Herman's bad mobiles. And I have to give the credit for the idea of the party to Chris Haberman, who was the sort of our art curator for the film. It was his idea to have this party and it was just genius. And then the mobiles that Herman makes after he meets the hole, which are really nice, are all made by the same gentleman who is an artist who I'm trying to remember his name now. I think his name is Chris as well. You can find him on IMDb. He actually never made mobiles before, but he was an artist. And so he made these pretty outstanding mobiles for us.
What has been some of the feedback that you've been getting from the film?
We got some awards. We had some festival screenings. So got some nice awards from that. It played in Fanisboa. It played at the London Sci-Fi Festival. So got a couple of awards in different places. Sean, the actor who plays Herman, got a Best Acting Award. I got a Best Directing Award. As far as, you know, now it's been released, I think it's kind of a mixed bag. It's definitely resonated with some people. Some people really like it a lot, but probably an equal number of people really don't like it at all. And so I think it's very 50-50. Some people hate it, you know, and I don't know. Maybe
do they give the reasons why?
Yeah. Not in so many words. I mean, the typical negative response is it sucked, you know? So it's not you can really go get too much from that. Some people say the acting is horrible. Some people say the acting is fantastic. It's really just all over the place. And it's been a good learning experience for me. I think it just, you know, has pointed out to me that there's really no one barometer for a film. You know, how IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes, that there's, you know, they have their 10 or 5 star rating. You really can't put a number to a film like that. It's not like you can Yelp review films, because one person may love the film and another person may hate the film. And it's just because people have very different tastes. I just from what Sam was saying before, the reason he likes horror films might be different from what, you know, some other person likes horror films for, and they both may have totally different reactions to the same horror movie, you know, and that's totally valid, you know? So, So yeah, I don't know. I can't speak for why a person might like or dislike Deep Tart. I just hope that it finds the audience that it enjoys it. I hope it can get out to those people. And for that reason, I thank you guys for doing these podcasts, for, you know, promoting independent film, because as a low budget film, we don't have money to advertise much. And so it's things like this that help us get the word out. So thank you.
And you also on your website, you're selling signed DVDs.
We are, yes. In fact, that is, if you want to support the filmmakers, that is one of the best ways to do it. If you like the film, please buy a signed DVD, or if you want, you can buy the screenplay on the Kindle store, the Deep Dark screenplay.
You were saying earlier the screenplay, is it different than the film? There's two different screenplays.
Yeah, it's slightly different. There's a few different scenes. It's not tremendously different, but it does explain a little bit more. So if you really are dying to, you know, get that, by all means, please do. And if you buy either of these two products, the money goes directly to the filmmakers. Whereas if you're, you know, renting it on Hulu or something, a third of that goes to Hulu, and then a third of that goes to the distributor, and then, you know, a small portion of that, maybe 50 cents, goes to the paying back our investors, which we'd love to eventually do.
And with the location, it was mostly filmed in Portland, Oregon, but there was the scene with Uncle Felix, was in Santa Barbara.
Yeah, that's right. I would say 99% of it is different locations in Portland. Both cities were really nice to us. The art galleries that we shot in were actual art galleries. And in fact, the gallerists were so gracious that they let us shoot there for free, which is almost unheard of. But we really appreciate that. Actually, they're unfortunately not even around anymore, these galleries, but the gallerists are, and they, you know, they were doing it to promote, to promote independent artists. And in fact, a lot of the art in the films in the background in the galleries were local artists. So, you know, we tried to sort of get some of that out there. In fact, some of the artists we've sort of singled them out on our Facebook page, and you can see some of their work. In fact, the woman who does the velvet painting that's over the hole, I'm a huge fan of hers, and she does velvet paintings, which is amazing. You could actually get a velvet painting commissioned by her. Actually, if you go to Chinatown, Los Angeles, because I know you're both not too far from there, the Velveteria, you know that place? It's a sort of a museum / art gallery that's all velvet paintings, and you can find some of this woman's velvet paintings in that store. But it's a really great place if you get to visit it. They have a whole section of, it's a whole room dedicated to Elvis, and another whole area dedicated to, I think it's crying clowns. I think sort of gangster clowns. So pretty amazing. But she's the one, this woman, her name is, I cannot remember her name right now, but Juanita, that's it. Juanita. Some of her stuff is up there too. She did the peacock painting that you see in the film.
And you've also done another of other short films. Were these within the sort of a horror or fantasy genre?
Kind of. I mean, they're in the same sort of not really horror sort of tone. We made a short film called Kitty Kitty, which is about It's a love story about brain parasites. It features one of my favorite diseases, which is toxoplasmosis, which is a brain parasite, but it's also a love story. And then there's a Rat Snitch Angel, which is a very, very short film, which is, I don't know. I couldn't really call it horror, but yeah, it's sort of that style.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank Michael Medaglia for being on. It's been an excellent show.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, Robert and Sam. Yeah, it's been a real pleasure.
You're welcome.